You're listening to a special showcase episode of the Round Table Podcast. 20 minutes with Mike Cole. Hello, everyone. I'm Dave Robison, and you are listening to 20 Minutes With, a special showcase episode of the Roundtable Podcast, where I have the distinct privilege and pleasure of sitting down for a few minutes with our guest hosts and picking their brains a bit, exploring their creative process, digging into what it is that they do when they work that magic mojo they do when they write their stories. I'm flying solo for this 20 minutes with my good master, Brian Humphrey. My usual co-host is AWOL. That's the word.
There you go.
So we're just going to roll right into introducing our guest host. And let me give you some lead up. I know you've already clicked the link. You know who it is. But Mike was actually very pleased to discover the breadth of work that you have out there. And let me share this with our audience. The L. Ron Hubbard Presents Writers of the Future, Volume 19. His story Blood and Horses appeared in that one. Naktong Flo appeared in Black Gate, Issue 13. And friends, if you haven't been to the Black Gate site, you got to make that scene. There's some awesome fiction out there. Appeared in Weird Tales, Issue 334, with the story A Place for Heroes. Shouting Down the Moon was included in the Book of Final Flesh anthology. And his work also appeared in the Best of All Flesh zombie anthology. I'm seeing a trend here. All right. He wrote Book 6 of the Wild She Chronicles, Car Trouble. His articles and commentary appeared on Tor and SF Signal. And he's also written some intriguing nonfiction on the Journal of Counterterrorism and Homeland Security International site. A diverse and broad-spectrumed individual, a true officer and a gentleman. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Skype line, Mr. Mike Cole. Mike, thanks for coming on the show, man.
Thanks very much for having me. That's the intro.
My singular pleasure. And of course, I completely omitted the shining jewel in that literary crown, Shadow Ops Control Point, which we'll talk more about later.
Sure.
But let's get into the 20 minutes with. I've got 20 minutes with you, and I'm clicking on the clock right now to make sure that I try and hold myself to just that. First and foremost, having read Shadow Ops Control Point, Mike, and what a great read. What a page-turning, awesome read.
Oh, thanks so much.
It occurred to me that one of the most common writing advices that is doled out to writers is write what you know, which is an interesting paradox for fantasy writers, because nobody knows about dragons, nobody knows about magic, it's all supposition and hearsay. And clearly you drew heavily on your background in the creation of Shadow Ops, and I wonder if you could talk a little bit about how you incorporated your own experiences in with the fantastic elements of the story.
This is, I think this is a distinct advantage that a lot of authors of what is called urban fantasy have. You see this a lot. Cassie Alexander has a novel coming out just now called Night Shifted. She is a burn trauma nurse in her real life. And it's an urban fantasy set in a burn ward, but at the very least, a hospital. Diana Rowland's Mark of the Demon is the first in, I think, something like 6 books she's put out from DAW, which I believe are police procedurals and based heavily on her experience as a sheriff in the Los Angeles County Police Department. I think I'm sort of taking a page from that book, and it's an advantage that urban fantasy authors do, because urban fantasy in its core is really what? It's taking the real world, the veneer of the real world, and painting magic over it. And so you can simply draw on whatever your real world experience is. I know your co-host happens to teach high school. His urban fantasy might be about a high school attempted by vampires or werewolves or what have you. So, magic was an easy, magic in the military was an easy step for me. I mean, there certainly is military fantasy out there. People keep bringing up Glenn Cook's The Black Company, and there's certainly a lot of precedents in comic book stories. I mean, Peter Brett called the series Black Hawk Down meets the X-Men, which I think is extremely accurate, and I think also accurately reflects the influence stories like the X-Men have had over me. But I was kind of surprised with the huge surge in popularity of urban fantasy lately that no one had thought to really deal with, because honestly, the military has changed so much very, very recently, in that we had a military that has been structured for what company grade officers like myself would call post-Westphalian warfare, state-based warfare with countries fighting countries. Okay. And since 9/11, we've had to shift very quickly to a stance of what we call COIN, or counterinsurgency, where we fight transnational threats, and where the line between enemy combatant and civilian is blurred, and the line between federal law enforcement and combatant is blurred. And so you have a very new and very exotic military culture that's even now in the presence of, process of evolving. So, you know, I just sort of thought it was a no-brainer to apply magic to that, but I guess maybe I got lucky, because to the best of my knowledge, and, you know, I'm always careful to say this because I, you know, you never know when someone's going to pop up and tell you you missed something, and Lord knows fantasy and science fiction are very broad. I don't know people who have really taken this sort of Black Hawk Down climate of, you know, fire team based counterinsurgency military with those big kinds of questions of who are we fighting against, who are we fighting for, and why are we fighting?
Sure, sure. No, I agree. I can't call anything to mind along those lines.
Yeah, I mean, so it was pretty easy to make that leap. And, I, you know, I've said this before in a lot of interviews. You know, at the time that I came up with the idea, I was working in the Pentagon. And Dave, I don't know, do you have experience working with the federal government or any kind of big bureaucracy?
Not really. I've led a blessed life in that respect.
Well, I mean, I think that anyone who works for a major corporation like IBM or, Apple or Microsoft or any Exxon, you know, any of these gigantic corporations probably have a similar experience. But the thing I keep seeing in gigantic bureaucracies is that when you've got to keep thousands of people and billions of dollars all moving in the same direction, you tend to, and I really think forgivably and necessarily, come up with a lot of regulations, right? You got to have rules. You can't let personal idiosyncrasies drive an organization of that size.
Sure. And that's a landmark. That's a cornerstone of the military structure. Yeah,
absolutely. And then when you do that, what happens? You wind up having to place process over people, and decent people, good people, when they come up against complicated questions, they sometimes get steamrolled in the process of using those regulations to protect the greater good. So I'm walking around the Pentagon when I was working there, and I'm wondering, you know, like, what if they had a Department of Magic? You know, what if what if there were elves and orcs or whatever working in this building? And I don't even think that that's that big a question for a nerd to ask. Like, when you're a serious down-home D&D playing comic book reading dork, you ask that question of every, you go into Victoria's Secret, you know, what if the lady at the bra section was an orc? You know, I mean, that's the kind of stuff that nerds think about.
Sure. As embarrassing. Actually, I think it would be succubus, but yeah.
Right, whatever. Yeah. As embarrassing as it is to admit that on the air, yes, I know. You get the idea. So, yep. You know, that's what I thought about. And of course, the first thing I thought of was they would totally screw it up. Like, they would make it boring and make it full of rules and make it, you know, suck the magic out of magic. Right. And they would do so to address with the dangers associated with it. And that was the kernel of the idea. And that was as far back as 98. And I built on that over the course of, wow, the next, sheesh, more than a decade before
yeah.
I really was able to get representation to bring that forward.
So, and that raises an interesting point, because, and I was so gratified. I've caught several of your interviews on Dead Robot Society and other places. And the fact that you're an inveterate and unforgiving nerd and game geek is, I can honestly say, is a great relief to all of us. that you can be a badass and you can be a game nerd somehow elevates all of us in some small way.
I appreciate that, and like, I get accused of being a badass all the time, and I don't know where people are getting it from.
Possibly your profile picture? I don't know, Mike. Dude.
Look at China Mayville's profile picture. You know, never judge a book by itself.
True that. But let me ask you, with your gaming background, and I, of course, have one as well, and probably most of our listeners do as well, while you were evolving the storyline, the plot, and the universe for Control Point, did you ever incorporate or utilize your game experience to I don't know, expand or deepen or explore different aspects of the story?
Hell yeah, of course. I mean, what? And if you look at my magical system, and this is the thing, is like, what are role-playing games and board games in science fiction and fantasy? They all start and sort of surround taxonomies and ontologies and organizations of you know, classes and schools of magic and races of player characters and races. The first thing you do in any game is sort of draw delineations. You know, are you playing? Right. Are you playing the Skavens, or are you playing Chaos, or are you playing Space Marines, or what's your deal here? And Control Point's magic system is 100% like that. You have, you know, the five legal schools and the prohibited schools, and each schools manipulate different kinds of elements and have different kinds of powers, and you have certain military units that do certain things, and, you know, I have, you know, my notes for the Shadow Ops series, which continue to evolve as I write more books, are essentially an RPG source book, right? You know, I mean, that is exactly what they are.
Totally.
Yeah, absolutely, my experience with games informed it. And the biggest compliment I take it as the biggest compliment is when people say, oh, man, this would be so cool if someone would make it a game. When is someone making it a game? And I sit there and ask them right back, goddamn right, when is someone making it a game? And actually, as long as we're on that subject, you know, there's one great guy to watch. You ever heard of his name? Is Joshua A.C. Newman. And he's on Twitter, and he's got a great Kickstarter project that was supported by Gabe and Tycho from Penny Arcade.
Oh, yeah.
He came up under a legal license. He was able to do this legally to make a giant robot war game based on Lego. And you build your own robots out of Lego.
I've heard about this Kickstarter, yeah.
It's called Mobile Frame Zero. I supported it. I stumped for it. It is so friggin' cool.
Is it still up? Is it still a live Kickstarter?
Oh, yeah, I think so. You have to Google it to double check, but I know they already reached their goal and went way past it.
Oh, sweet. Good. That's awesome.
It is awesome, but the point I'm making is that when you meet Joshua, and he's an inveterate congoer. You can always find him in the game room. He's got a ponytail and thick mutton chops, easy to spot. He understands how to make systems work. And he understands how to make mechanics work. And those are the kinds of things you really need to be a game designer. The story is just one piece of it.
Sure. We'll be back with more of our conversation with Mike Cole after this promotional break.
Hi, this is Hugh, the host and editor of the Way of the Buffalo podcast. Twice a month, we present the best short fiction of all genres, thought-provoking interviews, and other diverse entertainments. You can find us online at wayofthebuffalopodcast.blogspot.com or search for us on iTunes. Some people say that short fiction is going the way of the buffalo. Come join us, won't you?
Now, let's get back to the conversation with Mike Cole. This isn't your first book. Your first book was The Wild She Chronicles. Is that correct?
Yeah, I don't really talk about that too much. And that's the only reason I don't is that I wrote that book when I was very young. And I did it, and more importantly, I did it as a work-for-hire gig in which I was paid a flat fee. And I was given an outline, and I was given character sheets.
Oh,
and
wow.
I basically wrote prose to someone else's story.
Ah, okay.
And so if people really like the book, I don't feel confident.
It's not your book.
Yeah, I don't feel confident in taking credit for it.
Sure.
And if people don't like the book, you know, and I'm sure every writer feels this way. You know, it was like one of the first pieces of professional commissioned work I'd ever done. And my writing, like any artist who keeps at it for a long time, has evolved a long way since then. Now, that said, I mean no disrespect against the series, which you know, I'm sure has brought a lot of, you know, a lot of people really like it. And I'm very, very pleased to have had a chance to participate in it. But, you know, since we're here talking about craft and those kinds of things, you know, that's really not the best example of what I've done.
Well, as a Lee, I mean, if nothing else, you had to write several thousand words of prose, whether it was your story or not,
right,
to make that book happen. Then Control Point, which is purely your baby and has been your creation, and you're continuing with Fortress Frontier and Breach Zone.
Right.
what did you discover? What do you wish someone had told you when you started writing Control Point that would have made your life a lot easier?
Oh, okay.
Let's just start with that question.
Man, this is an easy one. Now, I know I'm going to deviate a little bit into what you didn't want to talk about, which is publishing and the business of publishing.
Okay. But
trust me, this is a craft question and it's a craft answer.
Cool.
Do you know Peter V. Brett? Are you familiar with his work?
I am not. I'm familiar with the name, not the work.
Okay. He's written two books so far. He just finished the third one. The first book is called The Warded Man, The Painted Man in England and Australia. The second book is called The Desert Spear. I believe both of them have been on the extended New York Times and London Times bestseller lists. They are sprawling, gigantic, epic fantasies, and they are absolutely amazing. I put him up there with George R. R. Martin in terms of his and Brandon Sanderson. Like, he's one of the Pat Rothfuss. He's one of the major forces in modern fantasy.
Epic scope.
Oh, not just epic scope, but epic talent. Like, I mean, you know, you can write a doorstop, right? I mean, lots of people write big, sprawling books.
Sure.
But Pete's, he's just a great writer. There's just no other way to slice it. And he's been my biggest influence. Hey, full disclosure, we're good friends. But I think even if we were bitter enemies, I would still absolutely stump for his work because it's really worth reading.
Okay.
Well, when Pete and I were in college and just after college, trading manuscripts back and forth and sort of dreaming about being professional writers, I had this idea that I don't know how I'd gotten this idea, but I'd gotten this idea that craft was somehow secondary and that the path to publication was who you know and knowing the business and writing short stories and winning Writers of the Future and going to the right parties and, you know, you had to write and you had to write well, but you know, you had to, this other stuff. You had to do this other stuff. You had to,
a lot of people believe that.
Yeah, and it's hogwash. I really,
I'm sorry. Thank you. That's my right there. Mike Cole says it's hogwash. Yes,
well, it was
I'm down
my,
with that.
It was my path. It's the path I took. But quite frankly, Pete, I remember having these conversations with Pete. It's like Pete never entered Writers of the Future, and Pete never wrote short stories. He didn't try to sell stories to Weird Tales. I remember going to conventions and sort of frankly stalking George Sithers, may God rest his soul, before he died, you know, to meet him and try to get an in with Weird Tales. And Pete would never do stuff like that. And I would say to him, well, you have to do that or you're never going to sell a novel. And Pete was like, Mike, I don't like short stories. I don't read short stories. I'm not interested in short stories. I want to write a great novel, and I'm going to go home, and I'm going to sit down, and I'm going to spend hours and weeks and months and years of my life developing my craft and writing novels until I write one that people are going to buy, because I know that if I write a dynamite novel, it'll sell. And I just, you know, that's such great and simple advice, and I couldn't hear it. And I was just so busy doing all this other stuff, and I had success. You know, I won Writers of the Future. I sold short stories. And my novels were just not good enough. And I'll never forget when Pete finally hit it, when he got... We both have the same agent. When our agent picked him up and when his book was just this breakout instant success, well, perhaps that's a bit of an exaggeration. It was an enormous success far more quickly than debut novels normally are.
Sure.
I really got a fire under me. And I, you can imagine, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I looked at it and I was like, what did this guy do? Because I remember reading the manuscript and just being totally blown away. And being very, very cognizant of how much better it was than my own. And just sort of asking, what did this guy do? And the conclusion that finally dawned on me over all those years was he focused on craft above everything else. And he made sure that he wrote the best possible novel he could produce. That he didn't try to compete. He didn't try to get published. He tried to produce a great work of art. And figured that the publication would be incidental to that. And I remember swearing to myself, all right, that's what I'm going to do. And this manuscript, which at the time was called Leighton, I am not giving this to Joshua to look at. Joshua's our agent.
Okay.
So I am sure that it's the greatest book ever written. and I went to ground. And I stopped the crap. And I focused on the craft. And what was ironic was I almost didn't even hand it in because I was so convinced it wasn't good enough. And the only reason I gave it to Joshua was because I was deploying to Iraq for my third tour and figured, yeah, I could get wasted over there. So, well, that sounds like I would do drugs. I could get killed over there.
Right.
So, you know, I'd rather have him have it. And it turned out that it was good enough. So if anything, it delayed it. But Dave, for your listeners, for any aspiring writer, yes, networking is important. Yes, parties and conventions and who you know is all important. Dear God, craft is so much more important than any of that. And if you write a stellar, killer, knockout, groundbreaking novel, then everyone rejects it, well, then you'll be Amanda Hocking. You know, then you'll self-publish
there
it.
There you go.
And you'll be a success that way. But good Lord, put craft first. That's the one thing I would say.
That's sound advice. And we at the Roundtable Podcast endorse and support that 100%. Mike, let me ask you one last question before we run out of time here. You're all good writers, and I'm sure you are pursuing the same thing, are always working on that craft, always working to refine whatever rough spots they feel are in their current skill set. And I wanted to ask, you finished Control Point, you finished Fortress Frontier, right?
Yeah, it's done. It's approved. I'm just waiting on copy yet.
Awesome. And you're working on Breach Zone. What are you working on now in your craft? What have you identified over these last projects? And what are you doing to refine and further hone your craft to be as good as you can be?
That's a great question. And this is the thing that gives me fits. I mean, when you're a pro writer and you're under deadline, I can't even begin to describe to you the anxiety when you sit down and write a book, because every book has got to be better than your last book. And I don't know if you know, but I quit a very lucrative, stable government job to do this full time. And if I screw it up, you know, you can imagine the pressure I'd put myself under.
Sure.
And Control Point's met with some strong initial success. I feel very confident about Fortress Frontier. I feel like it's I've done better with that book. The readers, of course, will be the judge, but at least so far I'm feeling pretty good about it. I can't even tell you the anxiety I'm facing with Breach Zone as I write it. This book has got to top, you know, the last two, or I'm dead in the water.
Right.
The two things I really think about, and the first one is the most important one, is when I've read the reviews and criticisms I've read of Control Point, people have issues with Oscar Britton's wishy-washiness. They feel that he flip-flops, that he isn't decisive enough. They wanted him to be more of a strong and decisive character. I very deliberately wanted to paint him as a human. I mean, I think that I want to take risks with fantasy. I want fantasy, the fantasy novels I write, to extrapolate realistically. And I wanted to think about what a real person, I mean, real heroism comes out of the decisions that real people make when confronted with real situations. If we're all supermen who know exactly what we want and never make a mistake.
And have nothing to risk.
Right. Then it's kind of boring. But, you know, the amount of criticism I got in that regard really made me think. And I've certainly am spending a lot more energy trying to see, trying to ensure that my characters are developing in a way where what they want is manifested more decisively and strongly in a way that I hope will resonate with the reader.
What steps are you taking to ensure that those characters are well-fleshed and laser tight in their execution?
I mean, I'm reading and I'm trying to spend, I mean, there's two things. One is patience. It's very, very easy to rush when you're writing and sort of burn through your scenes and not take the time to think clearly about what your characters were doing. You know, this is the one thing that really, really worries me when I write, is that all of my favorite writers tell me that they can take characters, put them on the stage, stand back, and those characters will actually dictate to them what happens. And the writers are just taking dictation from their own characters. That's how fully realized they are. I've heard Quentin Tarantino say this. I've heard John Hemery, a.k.a. Jack Campbell, say that. I've heard Peter Brett say that. And so I get really nervous because I'll put my characters on stage and I'll stand back and they'll look at me and they'll be like, what do you want us to do, Paul? And there's a couple of occasions where they have told me, you know, and have said, no, we're not doing what you want us to do here. We're doing this. And those occasions really make me feel like I'm getting it right. And I feel like those happen when I'm really able to slow myself down and pay attention and think carefully about what's motivating these people and who they really are and what they want. And
how much backstory do you evolve on your characters, just out of curiosity?
Every single one has their own story written. One of the things that I would love to do one of these days is I have an origin story written for every single character that you or pretty much every single character that you meet in Control Point. And one day, you know, I'd love to do a Shadow Ops Origins sort of book chapter for short stories. But yeah, I mean, Fitzy has a backstory. Harlequin has a backstory. Therese has a backstory. It's not just Oscar Britton. And I definitely know where they all came from and where they want to go.
Okay. Okay. And I can just offer a suggestion, something that might be outside of your wheelhouse, but might offer up some opportunities. Always take an acting class.
Yeah, you know, and I've done some acting.
Okay.
I'm really glad you brought that up, because I did a blog post on this. And if there's one thing I think that writers need to get character right, and character is absolutely the core of all good writing, I think, the most important thing, more important than plot, more important than anything else, is compelling characters, is empathy. You have got to be able to look at people who are nothing like you and get what makes them tick.
Yes.
And being judgmental, which, you know, God help me, I am, is the worst curse a writer can struggle with, because it gets you to dismiss other people's motivations and not take the time to step into them. And the best example of this is George R. R. Martin, the good example, not the bad example. I mean, look at this guy. He writes from the perspective of Arya, who's a young tomboy, and also Sansa, who's a very girly girl adolescent, and Cersei, who's a haughty queen, and Tyrion, who's a midget cripple, and Jaime Lannister, who's a great warrior. I mean, like, and on and on and on. Like, this guy is so empathetic. To be able to step into the skins of so many people that are nothing like him. And I really think that acting is a big piece to train yourself to do stuff like that.
Absolutely. I'm struck by the number of writers and authors that we've had on the show that have some sort of theater background. I think it's an invaluable tool to have, and for exactly that reason, for that empathy, and also for the inner construction that you have to do as an actor. To effectively and authentically portray a character on stage, you have got to know them down to your cellular level, emotionally and intellectually. And it really kind of breaks down a lot of the rational barriers that people put around character. You know, it's easy to frame a character in words, but when you have to be them, there's more than just thought involved with that. So, okay, cool.
That's a great point.
Well, Mike, we could do this for a very, very long time, and this is why we chop it off at 20 minutes, because otherwise we would be here all night, and we both have things to do. So let me thank you from the bottom of my heart. We really appreciate you coming on the show and sharing your thoughts, your experiences, and your insights with our audience. We're much obliged.
Oh, that's my great pleasure to be here.
Outstanding. Thank you. Friends, stay tuned next week. We'll have Mike Cole back on to workshop a story by John Walker, author of Supernatural Gumshoe Tales. In the meantime, as Brian would say if he were here, go write. And as I tell you, friends, you find what you're looking for and you get what you give. Until next time, you guys take care. We'll talk to you soon. Until then, bye-bye.
This episode is copyrighted 2012 by the Roundtable Podcast and is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share Alike license. That means don't sell it, but you can share it all you like. And you can even use pieces of it in your own derivative work, as long as you attribute us as the source and release the work under the same licensing terms. Theme music composed and performed by the talented Hepcats of Brotown, Gary Gold, David LaBruyere, Billy Nobel, and Matt O'Donnell. If you'd like to be a guest writer or guest host, or learn more about the Roundtable Podcast, please visit our website at www.roundtablepodcast.com. Or visit our Facebook page at facebook.com/roundtablepodcast. Our Twitter tag is @writerspodcast. Or just send us an email at thetable@roundtablepodcast.com. Thanks for listening.